Good morning. Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. I can't believe anybody's here. There was no such thing as a plow when I came in several hours ago. Maybe that was better. I just slipped and slid my way. Don't know if we have any visitors or guests this morning. I don't think we do. Not surprising. It's still kind of a holiday. There's always a debate in the program committee and other places about whether we go through the spiel every week about being welcome. But most of us want to hear it, I think, whether we have guests or visitors or not. So welcome, no matter where you are on your spiritual journey, no matter your sexual preference, no matter your ethnicity, no matter who you are, as I said, where you are on the journey of life, we welcome you. And we want you to come back because our services are different every week. The opening words are these. May we be reminded here of our highest aspirations and inspired to bring our gifts of love and service to the altar of humanity. May we know once again that we are not isolated beings, but connected in mystery and miracle to the universe, to this community, and to each other. Flame of fire, spark of the universe that warmed our ancestral hearth, agent of life and death, symbol of truth and freedom, we strive to understand ourselves and our earthly home. Before I give you my reflections about addiction, I have a few things to read from a book titled Clean by David Sheff, from which I drew a lot for this morning. He writes, "The view that drug use is a moral choice is pervasive, pernicious, and wrong. So are the corresponding beliefs about the addicted, that they're weak, selfish, and dissolute. If they weren't, when their excessive drug taking and drinking began to harm them, they'd stop. The reality is far different. Using drugs or not isn't about willpower or character. Most problematic drug use is related to stress, trauma, genetic predisposition, mild or serious mental illness, use at an early age, or some combination of those. Even in their relentless destruction and self-destruction, the addicted aren't bad people. They're gravely ill, affected with a chronic, progressive, and often terminal disease. People also believe that addicts can't be treated. At best, they can muster their willpower and manage their compulsion for a short time. But while it's true that addicts who seek treatment are seldom cured, their disease is treatable when we reject the pseudoscience, moralizing, and scare tactics that characterize the current system. The disease of addiction can be prevented, and when we treat it the way we treat other diseases, those in its thrall can be freed to live long, full, healthy lives. This stigma associated with drug use, the belief that bad kids use, good kids don't, and that those with full-blown addiction are weak, degenerate, and pathetic, this stigma has contributed to the escalation of use and has hampered treatment more than any single other factor. Mental illness, divorce, trauma, poverty, addiction in the family tree. Millions of people have these and other risk factors. and a combination exponentially increases the odds that a person will abuse drugs. Add those to the many other reasons people use, the way drugs can, at least temporarily, treat physical pain and lessen inhibitions, the way they can help people cope with loneliness, insecurity, and stress, the cultural acceptance of drugs, and the messages in the media. Rather than being surprised that some people use drugs, we should be surprised that some don't. Effective drug use prevention involves parents, schools, and communities, and it also involves acknowledging and countering a culture in which kids are deluged with positive depictions of drugs. Unless you've been there, you can't imagine what it's like to watch helplessly as someone you love descends into addiction. The transformation defies logic until you understand that your loved one is gravely ill with a brain disease that's debilitating, chronic, progressive, and, if left untreated, fatal. Once and for all, people must understand that addiction is a disease. It's critical if we're going to effectively prevent and treat addiction. Accepting that addiction is an illness will transform our approach to public policy, research, insurance, and criminality. It will change how we feel about addicts and how they feel about themselves. But there's another essential reason why we must understand that addiction is an illness and not just bad behavior. We punish bad behavior. We treat illness. There are two ways people become addicted. Anyone who takes enough of a drug to cause severe structural and functional changes in the brain can become addicted. But, and this is the more common one, those people who become addicted do so because their brains are different before they use drugs, not because they use them. There's evidence that addicts' brains are different from birth. The main problems with America's addiction treatment system stem from its roots in the archaic notion that addiction is a choice, not a disease. One common symptom of the disease of addiction is relapse. Kicking an addict out of treatment for relapsing is like kicking a cancer patient out of treatment when a tumor metastasizes. The philosophy behind such treatments is that addicts are undisciplined and morally bankrupt, so they have to be punished. Former Congressman Patrick Kennedy, yes, of that family, who's been open about his addictions, summed up the problem with sad, hard-won eloquence. "I've made a very close personal analysis of treatment centers. I've gone to the best in the country myself. It's all based upon treating your weakness instead of your strengths. Chef says, I've never heard of any disease that responds to censure, blame, or denial of treatment." And finally this. For centuries, we've treated addicts as immoral, weak, and pathetic. We told them to just say no, but they didn't. We declared war on them and locked them up, but they kept using. We judged them, vilified them, and banished them, yet they still took drugs. Our best efforts to stop them from using didn't work because we didn't understand the most important fact. Addiction is a disease with a neurologic basis, a mental illness. When we understand this, we can finally put aside our prejudices and outrage and see that addicts aren't bad people, immoral, weak, or degenerate. Blame, shame, and anger can be replaced by compassion. Would that I had known that 40 years ago. I would have treated some people who are very close to me a whole lot differently. In the beginning, that is, at the beginning of our lives, if we are fortunate, the people present at our birth and during those first days, weeks, months, years of our lives, if we are fortunate, those people wish and want and imagine nothing but good things for our lives. Who looks at a newborn and says, maybe she or he will grow up to become an alcoholic or a drug addict? Years ago, a friend of mine, a biased, incredibly racist friend, who had not had an easy life, who lived in, at one point, right before I met her, what we then called the slums of Milwaukee, she fled with three very young children from an abusive husband. So I suppose that knowing this history of hers, I cut her a lot of slack. Years ago, she complained to me about all those parents, those black parents, who let their children become addicts. Parents whom she claimed turned their kids into addicts. Well, at the time, there happened to be a television commercial about raising children and the importance of parental and community guidance. The ads would show the birth of a baby with the parents imagining that baby ice skating as they grew up, or playing football, or going to college, or marrying and having children of their own. And then the ads would point out the obvious. No one pictured that baby becoming a drug addict or an alcoholic. Well, when I pointed this out to my friend, she really didn't have a comeback. In fact, she looked bewildered, as if she'd never thought of it that way. At this official beginning of a new year, many of us have good intentions regarding this upcoming brand new year. Some of us might even make resolutions in which we pledge to make the new year a better one for us and for maybe the world than the old year was. As it says at the top of your order of service, Pooh and Piglet had an interesting conversation about this. What day is it? Asked Pooh. It's today, squeaked Piglet. My favorite day, said Pooh. Every day, of course, is a new beginning, not just New Year's Day. Pooh has the right idea, the right attitude. Today is the only day that we can do anything about, really, no matter how much planning we do. For those addicted to alcohol or drugs, today is what treatment programs focus on, that is, good, effective treatment programs. They help addicts concentrate on right now. Now, I realize that there are many kinds of addictions. We are probably all addicted, at least mildly, to something. But this morning, I'm talking specifically about alcohol and drug addictions, as is Chef in his book. But what I have to say and what Chef writes are applicable to any addiction. As I'm sure you gathered, because I kept repeating it in the readings, one of the premises of David Chef's book, Clean, is that addiction is not a choice. Addiction is a disease. But unfortunately, we as a nation continue to ignore this and to cling to the belief that addiction is a moral problem. The old way of thinking claims that people have a choice, and if they would simply stop using, simply in quotes, then the addiction problem would be solved. In this way of thinking, addicts are weak, selfish, thoughtless, morally bankrupt, sinful even, in need of redemption. But addicts are just like those who are not addicted. People trying to cope with life, trying to find a way through confusion, darkness, hopelessness, emptiness, ways of being that we all encounter in this journey. Addicts have a spiritual hunger that I maintain we all have. In fact, I believe that addicts often have an even deeper craving for meaning than those who aren't addicted. I have been thinking about doing a service on the subject of addictions for some time, but addiction is an extremely daunting, complex subject, both intellectually and emotionally. I think that you would be hard-pressed to find anyone who has not been affected by addiction, or who has no personal knowledge of it. In my family, we had, among others, Aunt Barb, my very favorite aunt, and her husband, Uncle Ray. But they only drank beer, though lots of it. So they couldn't be alcoholics, could they? Ongoing conversation as I was growing up. Then there was my biological father, whom I never knew until the very end of his life. Supposedly, and he died in his 80s, he was an alcoholic, at least that's the family narrative. And when I was born, he may or may not have been on a bender. But my mother divorced him. I think she started the proceedings before I was even born. So I found it interesting and almost amusing that I plunged into reflecting, writing, reading about addiction, not by examining my own relationship to alcohol, my drug of choice, alcohol, nor by taking a close look at my family of origin and their use or non-use of drugs. No, I didn't look at any of that initially. I began with a dry, scholarly, heavily researched book that I have been intending to read for several months, Clean, by David Sheff. Sheff wrote Clean after another book of his was published. That book was titled Beautiful Boy. Have any of you read that book? No? I am not sure. Well, when I was serving the Green Bay congregation, someone there gave me Beautiful Boy. This was in the this would have been about 2005 or 6. I am not sure why that person thought it might be something I should read. Perhaps I had made some allusion to alcoholism or drug abuse in some service. Beautiful Boy is about David Sheff's son, Nick. Nick, who suffered from bipolar disorder and depression probably as early as middle school. Nobody caught that, despite good medical care. We are talking about a normal, happy family, an affluent family here, living in the San Francisco Bay Area. If the name David Sheff sounds familiar to you at all, he's a writer for The New Yorker and Rolling Stone and Slate and lots of other things. Nick got perfect grades. Nick was a star athlete. Nick's parents were in their first and only marriage, but no trauma from divorce. But Nick started using, you know, because he was at a party and somebody offered him a joint, and kids are kids, and they try stuff. Nick was on the streets eventually, right after he was a senior in high school. He did make it through a couple years of college okay, kind of okay. Eventually, he'd call his dad to come and get him. His dad would try to get him into a rehab program. Rehab programs, good ones, are not cheap. They're very, very expensive, actually. But they had the money. They put him in. Nick would try it for a while. Nick would leave the rehab. Nick would relapse. Nick would be on the streets. Nick would call his dad. Back to treatment. Relapse. Rehab. Endlessly repeated. Endlessly. Nick almost died. He would disappear for weeks and even months. As far as I know, he's still alive. He had been clean for at least 5 years when Clean was published. So he's been clean for 7 or 8 years. He goes with his dad on lecture tours. I could not finish Beautiful Boy. It broke my heart. It hit too close to home, too close to the bone. And this was before major alcohol-related things started mowing down so many of my close friends. But this was after one of them had already been struck down. One of those close friends had a major stroke and has never recovered. And that aunt of mine, she was getting closer and closer to the slow death by beers that she had been engaged in for so many years. The difference for me was that I was becoming aware of what she was doing. Nick's struggles remind me of Eduardo's struggles. Eduardo, whom we met in today's story for all ages, he didn't set out to be the horriblest boy in the whole wide world any more than Nick Sheff did. Nor did he, or presumably his parents, consider at the beginning of his life that he might become the nicest boy in the whole wide world. Actually, I'm not sure Eduardo had any parents. They don't seem to be present in the book. And I think he might have been a sociopath in the making. But for our purposes today, I think we'll assume, as I said a few minutes ago, that hardly anyone wakes up one day and says, I think I'll become an alcoholic. Or, today I really want to work on getting addicted to drugs. I was lucky. And I grew up in an almost substance-free household. I mean, addictive substances. My parents did not drink. Well, except on New Year's Eve, when they each had one, Tom and Jerry. I'm not sure what a Tom and Jerry is, but this was a big deal. My mother got quite silly, although it was kind of hard to tell sometimes because she tended to be a little silly. But. And my dad got, now I'm not talking about my biological father, I'm talking about the man who adopted me and whom I thought of as my dad. He became maybe a little less serious when he had his one Tom and Jerry, but he was really, really adamantly opposed to drinking. Well, of course, if we happened to be visiting that aunt and uncle of mine, the drinks flowed, and it didn't have to be New Year's Eve. And there was a lot of talk, as I said, about whether they could be alcoholics because they only drank beer, but the talk was behind their backs. Nobody ever tried to talk to them about it, to my knowledge. And then there were the stories about my favorite grandfather, the person to whom I was the closest in my growing up years, Granddad. Apparently, he was quite the entrepreneur during Prohibition. There was a lot of bathtub gin making. No, I do not remember Prohibition. I was not around. But I've heard all the stories, of course. This grandfather had spent some time on the vaudeville circuit. He was 4'11". He was a great tap dancer. I remember one of his favorite skits, which he loved to perform. The viper is coming! The viper is coming! Oh, we were all so afraid, fear and trembling. I've come to vipe the windows. It's vaudeville. For some reason, I associate this vaudeville humor with the making of that bathtub gin. Did that granddad drink? He must have. But I never thought of this until fairly recently. Why else would he have been making that rot gut stuff? And he was the father of Aunt Barb. I also remember being told that the local police were in on this manufacturing of an illegal substance. They probably were all drinkers too. And we know how Prohibition turned out, about as well as the war on drugs. When my dad, that person whom I call dad, was in his 80s, and he and I had gone to Europe 3 times for D-Day remembrances, my dad lost a leg in the Battle of the Bulge, he told me why he was so opposed to drinking. Towards the end of the war, when our troops were starting to take over some of the German towns and villages, we had so many casualties that people who started out fairly low were rising in the ranks, and my dad became a master sergeant. And he was in charge of this group of men, and they secured that town. And they would go into the German houses and stay overnight and use the beds and use the kitchen stuff and cook and so on. Well, one night in a very, very nice house, a mansion almost, the men under my dad's command got very drunk. My dad did not. I'm positive his parents did not drink. Drinking just wasn't, you know, in my dad's frame of reference or something. And in this drunkenness, after they ate, they threw all the plates, which were very exquisite, apparently, out the window. They just threw them all out, which really upset my dad, I guess. There were probably other reasons why he didn't drink, but this kind of behavior went against everything that this man who raised me, believed in, apparently even in the midst of war. Which brings me to a word that cannot be ignored when talking about addictions, and that word is spirituality. I've already gone there, so to speak. I just didn't use the word spirituality a few minutes ago when I talked about how all of us, all humans, struggle. I don't care if you're an addict or not an addict, at least not right now. All people, every day, are trying to cope with life, trying to find a way forward through confusion, darkness, hopelessness, emptiness, ways of being that we all encounter in this journey. Well, I thought I could give you a dynamite definition of either the word spiritual or spirituality this morning, because I know that these can be words that Unitarian Universalists struggle with from time to time. I also am very well aware of the fact that AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, does not always work because of its use of what I will call loaded language. Words like higher power, sin, redemption, even the words moral inventory and forgiveness can seem like, well, trick words, if not trick questions. Words that sometimes put people on the defensive. And I understand this backing away from seemingly loaded language, especially if we call ourselves atheists or humanists. But there's still a spiritual component necessary when talking about addiction and how to live with it. But there's no dynamite definition. Even the dictionary is pretty vague about spirituality. And the only definition I could come close to relating to is this one: relating to or consisting of spirit, sacred, soul, holy. So of course I had to look up spirit. It's, you know, you're getting those loops. Spirit, the breath of life. Life itself. Not just the material, physical, you can see it part of what we call life. So here we are with these physical cells, with our bodies, but that's never all that we are. We also have this non-physical, non-material part, which is the very essence of who we are. Our spirit, our unique energy, our unique persona, which has very little to do with our physical selves, unless you're a teenager. That broken spirit that accompanies addiction, probably precedes it, actually, that broken spirit, we all suffer from this, has to be healed every bit as much as any broken parts of our physical cells that occur because of addiction. I do not think it is possible to live with addiction unless this aspect is addressed, named, worked on, whatever language you want to use. If you're uncomfortable with using the word spiritual, find another one. Maybe sacred, maybe holy. How about mysterious? Awesome in the best sense. Not, oh, that's so awesome, but awesome in its best, its best original sense. How about unknowable? However you describe this non-material, non-physical part of who we are, I do not believe that addiction can be confronted successfully, or that any individual can successfully confront addiction without finding a way to fill the emptiness. The emptiness in life. To counteract that abyss that we all stare into from time to time. So what do I mean exactly, though, at this point in time when I use the word spirituality? My first semester in seminary, I took a class for an entire semester titled Alcoholism and Spirituality. I spent an inordinate amount of time this past week looking for a paper that I wrote for that class. I did not find it. I'll probably find it tomorrow. But I am quite sure that the perfect answer to the connection between alcoholism and spirituality is in that paper. But I'll give you some clues here in the next couple minutes. Chef didn't really get into spirituality in the book Clean, at least not explicitly. Was he a wise man or a cowardly man? Well, he couldn't avoid getting into the spirituality component of addictions when he wrote Beautiful Boy. But his chapter on AA in his book Clean is as close as he comes to using problematic words. I could do another whole morning on how he dissects AA. He's ambivalent about it. He thinks the second A needs to come out. It should not be anonymous. By keeping it anonymous, you just continue to bury the disease. You're burying it doesn't get any publicity, and it doesn't get any, you know, the squeaky wheel. Do some of you remember when nobody talked about cancer? It's maybe the big C. What happened? Well, the American Cancer Society was very instrumental in getting it out there, in front of us. Research money started coming in. Did you know that the American Cancer Society was started in 1913? So this did not happen overnight. Remember AIDS, which is still with us, unfortunately, but remember the, I think this was in the late 80s, Act Out, the Act Out protests and demonstrations? It's on the internet. Get it out there. The squeaky wheel gets greased. And I have some really good news about that and in regards to addictions. I was going to take you through the Chef's six precepts, but I'm running out of time. Oh, how funny that would happen to me. There are so many stories, personal stories I can tell you. That would probably make me cry. I don't know where to begin. A year ago, May, I got a phone call that one of my dearest friends was in the hospital here in Madison and had a major stroke. Well, it turned out to not be quite your ordinary stroke. It wasn't heart-related. It was all a neurostroke, and he had something called Wernicke's encephalopathy, a.k.a. wet brain. It's only caused by abuse of alcohol. This man's in his 80s, and none of you know him, and I'm not going to give you his name, of course. He's still alive. I try to visit him. He's not who he was. He taught me how to drink Irish whiskey, which I imbibed a great deal. I won't touch it now. And then there was my friend, also here in Madison, in the early 90s. There were four of us. We were all in the choir at First Unitarian. We were extremely close. And that's how my connection with Northern Minnesota started. Some of you know I have that connection because one of those four women had gone up there as a child. We were all big drinkers. I am extremely fortunate that apparently I don't have the brain that was different to begin with. I don't do much anymore in that regard, but I enjoyed my party years. Well, the other three of us decided that we needed to confront the one person we thought was really, really drinking way too much. So we went to lunch, which we often did. We kind of raised our kids together. It was that time period when you make sometimes good friends because your kids are all the same age. So the four of us went out to lunch to confront her. First, we ordered wine. Gotta laugh, right? I could cry. So she did have a major, major stroke. And now that when I look back on it, I think it was probably the same thing, the Wernicke's encephalopathy. But I went to meet with this person's doctor. This was before HIPAA and so much privacy stuff. And this doctor, well-trained, young, seemed on top of everything. She completely dismissed me, not because I was breaching any confidentiality or privacy stuff. She told me that my friend was such an intelligent person, she'd never choose to drink too much. She knew better. She would know better than to drink too much. This was the 90s. And then there was Emily, who was my daughter's age, and like she was the child of one of these four people. Three people, not counting me, and she was like a daughter to me, because all the kids were like, you know, we were like moms to all those kids. We should have recognized the signs when she was at West High. Such a good school, right? It was a really good school for my kids, but Emily couldn't read. And none of us realized this till she was like a senior in high school. I started tutoring her then a little bit, but it was too late. And there's so much stigma around that, and she just never felt right. She never, well, you know how high school is. Most of us know how it is. Beautiful girl, brilliant girl. Emily died of an overdose in 2004, I think, or five. Her mother, one of those four women, including me, mother is alive but has been drinking since her kids were little, and we never picked up on it. The vodka in the Coke. Okay, enough of all that. The happy news, if there is any. Oh, and then there was the phone call I got Thanksgiving weekend from someone I've known since I was the minister in Plattsburgh, New York. And this person was in my congregation there, but he has ties to Madison. And he called to say that he had just been kicked out by his wife. He said, I've got two little kids because of his drinking. And he had gone into a rehab here in town. And could I help? And talk about being blindsided. I never would have guessed this. I mean, high-functioning alcoholic. To be continued. Sometimes thought poo, this is another poo thought. Sometimes life is just one bother after another, Pooh said. And yes, it is, but there are signs of hope. I am a seventh principle preacher. You all know what the seventh principle is, right? That we are all connected. It's right on, if you're new here, it's on the inside, right before the hymn start, I think, of the hymnal, right at the beginning. The seventh principle is that we are all connected. And that, to repeat some of the opening words, may we know once again that we are not isolated beings, but connected in mystery and miracle to the universe, to this community, and to each other. We have each other. There are so many people right now working to better understand addictions all over the world. There's amazing stuff coming out of China. And we now have something called the AAS, the American Addiction Society, brand new, modeled on the American Cancer Society. David Sheff was not a founding member, but he's on the board now. Did you know that there are a whopping total of 2,500 doctors in the United States, 2,500 who are addiction specialists? Do you know how many oncologists there are? 12,500. Cardiologists, 20,000. We have hope, though, and the knowledge that people can change. We have at least some compassion. Of course, we always need to cultivate more compassion. We need more money to fund research. We need better trained doctors, nurses, physicians, assistants, ministers, therapists, psychiatrists, teachers. We all need to be better trained. And we need to learn more about the American Addiction Society. And we need to not be afraid of changing the way we think. The other day in a coffee shop, Todd, you know who Todd is? He's our architect. Is the architect. Well, Todd and I run into each other all the time. And Breaks on Monroe Street. I was kind of writing yesterday in the coffee shop. And he said, what are you doing? What's the subject? And I told him, we got talking about addictions. And he said, you know, I was in here the other day in the coffee shop. And this young man had on earphones and was talking to somebody on a cell. Well, you know, lots of times I think everybody raises their voice more than they need to when they're talking on cell phones. Plus, he had the earphones on. Well, it was obvious to everybody sitting in the coffee shop that he was talking to his girlfriend. And it was something about heroin. So finally somebody went over to him and said, tone it down. So he loses the earphones, you know, and he gets off and he said, oh, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry now. I suppose you heard all that stuff about heroin. I didn't want you to hear that. It was so terrible. You shouldn't hear that. It was awful. He was embarrassed. We haven't changed enough. Society still thinks it's a stigma to be addicted. Now, we can begin a discussion, but we're no way going to finish it, I'm sure. But maybe we can continue it at another time. As I said, we could probably do a whole month of Chef's book. Interventions normally don't work. And I agree with that. And he also is very clear about, forget that old adage that the addict has to hit bottom. Intervene, not in the sense of a formal intervention, say something and help them get help, because bottom is often death. Closing words are these. Take courage, friends. The way is often hard. The path is never clear. And the stakes are very high. Take courage. For deep down, there is another truth. You are not alone. Go in peace, greet your neighbor, eat cake, get to know the visitors. Be careful out there.